2012, January 4th. Today is Lecture 2, Astronomical and Biological Numbers. Well, before we can actually dive into the material of this course, we need to establish some common language. And all fields, no matter whether they're sciences, humanities, or otherwise, almost naturally develop their own specialized vocabularies. And in the sciences, especially for astronomy and biology, we have to use specialized units and ways of expressing things quantitatively. Some of you may have seen this material before, so it'll be a nice review. But what I want to go over today are the way we're going to be expressing numbers on both astronomical to biological scales in this class. That way I can start slinging around light years and astronomical units and nanometers and microns, not have you get hit with those things for the first time when I encounter them. So today we're going to talk about astronomical and biological numbers. Now, all of my lectures, since this is the first real formal lecture of the course, are going to begin like this. They're going to begin with an introductory slide, sometimes pretty specifically, saying what the major topics are. This is the roadmap for the lecture. And today, in particular, what we're going to be talking about is the use of scientific notation. So you've all probably seen scientific notation before, but we're going to reintroduce it so everyone's on the same page. Particularly, I also want to emphasize that in this particular lecture, we're going to emphasize that we're using the metric system. There's only three countries in the world that still use English imperial units. They are Liberia, Burma, Myanmar, now as they like to call themselves, and the United States. So the world's largest industrial nation, a small corrupt Southeast Asian dictatorship, and a heavily impoverished West African nation. Great company. We're going to have to deal with metric. Metric is used in the sciences. We're just going to have to deal. I know Americans are real wimps when it comes to metric, but we got to deal. But in particular, you know, we're going to go over metric pretty fast. What I really want to emphasize today are some specialized units that we're going to be using over and over again, especially in the astronomy and biology sections of this course, where I have to talk about things that are very large or very small. And I have to use certain subsets of units which are more natural for those scales. So, for example, in the solar system, I'll talk about a size scale which is set by the size of the orbit of the Earth, the so-called astronomical unit. We talk about distances between stars, we'll talk about the light year. If you want to talk about those in kilometers, as we'll see, it gets kind of inconvenient. And similarly, we'll have comparable numbers when we talk about biological scales, which get down to sub-fractions of a meter. So here's the problem. When we start talking astronomy, when we get off of human-scale things, we suddenly find ourselves in the realm of really, really big numbers. And I can just pull up three as an example that we're going to encounter in various cases. So, for example, the average distance of the Sun from the Earth is 149,597,870.691 kilometers. That's just a big number. The mass of the Sun is... There are some languages, I think, in which you can say this, and I once tried to figure out how to say it in terms of million quadrillions, but it's just a great big number with a whole lot of zeros on it for measuring the Sun's mass in kilograms. We talk about the age of the Earth, it's about 4.6 billion years. But if I notate it in full notation, I'm still carrying a lot of zeros around. We sling around billions, virtually unspeakable numbers. I mean, maybe if you spoke, you know, Japanese has got some wonderful words for extremely large numbers buried deep inside of it. But those are not very convenient ways of talking about things. We need a much more compact notation. Now, this isn't just a problem for astronomy. There are some big numbers associated with some very familiar non-astronomical things. For example, this being an election year, God help us, we're going to be hearing an awful lot about debt. A lot of uninformed information about debt, as it seems, but an awful lot of words. Here is, in fact, the U.S. national debt as of just before the end of the year, which is the latest time the United States Treasury posted it. It is 15,125,800,000, yeah, well, you get the idea, a whole bunch of, about $15.1 trillion, most of which is actually owed to the United States, but, you know, that's the way it goes. Perhaps something a little bit more fun to think about than U.S. national debt is the number of Oreo cookies that have been sold since the Oreo cookie was introduced in 1910 or so. Nabisco or its subsidiaries have produced, in the United States alone, 491 billion Oreo cookies to date. To put that in perspective, since this is an astronomy class, there are only 200 billion stars, we think, in the Milky Way galaxy. So this is enough Oreo cookies to give one cookie to every star in the Milky Way and its sister galaxy, Andromeda, and still have a couple cookies left to hand out to class. So it isn't even on modern industrial scales. Modern industrial economies and modern industrial systems are capable of producing things on scales that begin to get to where we have to use specialized notation to talk about these big numbers. When we go to the other scale that we're going to deal with in this class, the level of biology, we suddenly find ourselves at the opposite extreme. These are scales which are much smaller than we experience in everyday life. And I've given three examples up here of fairly typical sizes of things. Viruses, which are the smallest things sort of on the boundary between living and non-living. E. coli bacteria, which you all have but don't want to encounter in some of their forms. And human blood cells that we all have. To denote the sizes of these things using units of meters for length and grams for mass in the standard metric system, you immediately run into a very large number of zeros before you get to the 2-8. And again, how do you say that in words? It's very, very difficult. Obviously, point 0000000028 meters for the typical size scale of these virus particles. That's just a very inconvenient way of talking. It's a very inconvenient way of doing the mathematics. It just makes life really difficult to carry all that stuff around. In fact, I have to point with my laser pointer at the zeros to say this off because I just know I'm going to lose track after about three. I'm going to blow it. So we've got to have a better way of notating this. And the way we deal with notating this in the sciences is we use the scientific notation. Scientific notation is basically a way of compactifying a large or very small number. And what we really do, what the scientific notation does, is it just basically gets rid of all those extra zeros because they don't matter. They're all zero, is a way of thinking about it. The number of them sets the scale, the power of 10. So what we do is we use powers of 10 instead of zeros to denote the number. So we split the number into two parts. The first part actually has a name. It's called the mantissa. It's basically the significant digits of the number, the quantity that actually matters. So for example, in this case, 1.9891. That's the thing we actually measured, about 2. I can handle 1, 2, 3, 4. And so what's nice about making the mantissa is the mantissa is always a number between 0 and 9.999, or essentially between 0 and 10. We can handle 0 to 10. That's easy. I got that many fingers. And if I run out of fingers, I can use a toe or two. To denote the magnitude of the number, I add on the exponent as a power of 10. This is, if you will, counting the number of places after the decimal place, the rest being filled in with zeros. So this already tells me, this number, in fact, is the mass of the sun in kilograms, is I've got a number like 1.989, and basically it would be followed by 30 minus 4, or 26 zeros, if I wrote it out in full format. But when I write it out as 10 to the 30, I'm in a very convenient mathematical form. Because if I now wanted to talk about 10 solar masses or 100 solar masses, I just multiply this number by 10 or 100. Yeah, but that would move the decimal place. So I simply add to the exponent, 1 or 2. So a 100 solar mass star would be 1.9891 times 10 to the 32. So all the math for multiplying by factors of 10 goes into the exponent. I don't care what goes on there because that stays fixed. If I wanted 2 solar masses, I would multiply the mantissa by 2. And if the mantissa multiplied by 2 suddenly went over 10, I'd move the decimal place 1 and increment or decrement, depending on which way I'm going, the exponent. I haven't had to write down any unnecessary zeros. It's a beautiful, very nice, compact notation. And again, I expect you've all seen this, but we're going to use this a lot in various times. So let's, in fact, carry on with a few examples. The mass of the sun can be written in a very compact notation. Instead of 26 zeros, I can write it as 1.981 times 10 to the 30 kilograms. And that's how I say it. 1.9891 times 10 to the 30 units. So it even gives me a convenient way to say it in words. Let's look at it the very small. We can go in the opposite direction. The diameter of a hydrogen atom, or at least the classical diameter, since hydrogen atoms are kind of fuzzy, it's hard to measure the edge, is point a whole bunch of zeros, 106 meters. I don't even know how to begin to say that, but in scientific notation, it's 1.06 times 10 to the minus 11 meters. This contains two very useful pieces of information for us, despite being a compact notation. is it immediately makes these very, very inhuman units suddenly accessible. We all have at least a reasonable notion of what a kilogram is. A kilogram, by the way, is exactly 1 liter of water at normal temperature and pressure. So the sun is equivalent to 2 times 10 to the 30 liters of water equivalent mass. So if I wanted to make up a solar mass of water, I would need 2 times 10 to the 30 liter bottles of water. So that immediately gives you I'm not sure I can deal with what 30 orders of magnitude is myself in my head, but at least I can wrap myself around it mathematically. For the size of the hydrogen atom, it's 1 part in 10 to the 11 the size of a meter. That's 1/10 trillionth of a meter. So it actually gives me a way of sort of thinking about, oh, that's really small, is a way of putting it. But it allows me to go from really big to really small to quantifying. Oh, it's about 11 orders of magnitude smaller than a meter stick, smaller than the typical span of a human set of arms. Or, oh, that's 30 orders of magnitude more massive than a liter of water. So this notation is not just simply a mathematical convenience, which is primarily what its utility is. It also serves a conceptual case. It lets us actually set the scale of things relative to the scales of things we know. And I've always been one of those people that, you know, I can do math pretty good. That's kind of why I do this for my job. But being able to get your hands around something, get your head around an idea, it's nice if you can relate it back to everyday things. It kind of sets the scale. Now, sometimes we'd like to actually use some extra words. Saying something, something times 10 to the third, 10 to the sixth can become tedious. So in the System International of Metric Units, a series of standard prefixes have been developed to take care of certain common powers of 10. And you'll notice they tend to be in units of 1,000 in each step. There's kind of a reason for that. We can kind of deal with 1, 10, 100 is not a bad unit because there's about 100 people in here. Actually, the max number of seats here is 90. Okay, but when I start getting up to 1,000, beyond 1,000, it's kind of hard to visualize. Is that 1,000 or 10,000 people? A full stadium, for example, over in the football stadium is 100,000 people. Okay, that gets to be kind of big. So we don't say 10 to the 5 people. We say 100,000 is the way we say it. And so we can make a little sort of shorthand. 1,000 is a kilo. So we could say there's 100 kilo people in the stadium. Yeah, it just sounds weird. We'll say 100,000. 10 to the 6 is a mega, like a megabyte or a megawatt. We'll often talk about mega years. Giga is for a billion, so I'll often use the word giga year. Now, I'll often switch because there's English conventions. So I might say, you know, 3.8 billion years ago, but I'll write it 3.8 GYR for giga year. We have to be flexible in our language. I have to speak English. I can't speak math all day. I could, but it wouldn't be pretty. When we get to the small range, and we can get these numbers, can get up to some fun stuff like tera. Used to be when I taught this class, tera was kind of, huh? Now a terabyte disk space is like $30, you know. So tera is now a modern unit. Everybody, get ready for the peta. The petabyte is coming. For those of you who do computer science, the petabyte is already here. It's 1,000 terabytes, but it's coming. Centa is the centimeter. It's about the width of a human finger. Milla for millimeter. We're going to do millimeters quite a bit in this class because that's sort of a typical biological large cellular cluster scale. Micro for micrometer, or there's a special version of it called the micron, is very common now for cellular scales. Nano, like a nanometer or nanogram, is very typical of viral scales or down to the scales of proteins. So, and pico is where you get down to really small things like picograms. There's even something even further. Anyone know what goes beyond pico? 10 to the minus 15? Nope. The atto. So we can talk about the mass of some virus particles are in attograms. I'll almost never use that. But it's just there for reference. So here's a sort of a scale diagram now for biological units. The typical biological scales that we're going to be concerned with are kind of meters and centimeters. Meter is kind of an organism, right? A human being's between 1 and 2 meters in size, depending on their age and stuff. Centimeters are sort of tissues or organs. We get down to animal cells, we immediately drop to 10 to the minus 5 meters, and all of a sudden the language becomes inconvenient. We talk to bacteria, we're 10 to the minus 6 meters. Viruses, between 10 to the 7 and 10 to the minus 8. proteins 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 9. Proteins are just an order of magnitude above atoms or so. So we'll develop two special words for shorthand for these very small scales. The first of these that I'm going to use a lot is the micron. Micron is a short version of the long word micrometer. Micrometer is just too many syllables, so it's been shortened over time to the micron. It's a Greek word meaning really small. A micron is 10 to the minus 6 meters. It's a micrometer. Okay? And it's going to be very useful to us in biological systems. So, for example, typical bacteria are between a half and 2 microns. A typical cell, a big cell and a big animal cell, like a liver cell in a human being or a skin cell, can be tens of microns in size. So I've dropped all those 0.000s, and I've dropped this inconvenient locution of, you know, 0.5 times 10 to the minus 7 meters. It's easier to say half a micron. A good number to conjure with for microns, the width of a human hair. Okay, first of all, 1,000 microns is a millimeter. The width of a fine human hair is tens of microns. So that gives you an idea of kind of where the scales go. The other scale we're going to run into every now and then is the nanometer, a billionth of a meter. It's sometimes okay to say a billionth of a meter, but nanometer is now more the conventional way to do it. This is a scale which is important when we start talking about viruses and proteins. So viruses tend to be tens, the very largest hundreds of nanometers in size, the very largest bacteriophage viruses. Proteins, the fundamental building blocks of cellular machinery, are going to be a few nanometers in size. Atoms drop down to about a tenth of a nanometer on average size, which is starting to tell you that proteins tend to be tens of atoms across. So we're now here in proteins, we're at the molecular level. Molecular level is nanometers. The cellular level is microns. The organism level is meters. So keep those things in mind. This will let us sling these around. Any question about these units or scientific notation before we head forward? Okay, let's get into a few specifics. Let's talk about the system of units we're going to use. There are lots of systems of units. The one we are going to adopt in the sciences is the metric system. This is the international system of units. That is that defines units of length, units of mass, units of time, and units of temperature. And we're going to be using these temperature, mass, length, and time units universally in metric. Occasionally, I'm going to slip into English because I'm an American, and I'm always going to use inches at some fundamental level. It's just burned in my brain. But you'll almost never hear the word pounds or other feet come out of my mouth. I'm trying to go metric. So we're going to be expressing lengths in meters, or we're going to be expressing them in suitably prefixed subsets, the centimeter, the millimeter, the micron, the nanometer. Masses we're going to measure in kilograms or kilos for short. Occasionally I'll use grams when we start talking about small stuff, but typically we'll talk about masses in kilograms. Time is the one we can all agree on because everybody uses seconds. So time will be measured in units of the seconds. Although when we start talking about geological time, we'll start talking in terms, or astronomical time scales, we'll talk in units of years. So we'll actually step a little bit out of the metric system for a while and talk about the year, which is the length of the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. It's the only sort of non-metric unit we will use regularly. And we will often prefix a year with like million year, billion year, but we'll notate it as M for mega year, G for giga year. And finally, we're going to be expressing temperature in the Celsius or Kelvin system. Now, I've been all for metrification since I was a school kid and the U.S. metrification effort began in the 1970s. I thought it was so cool when kilometers showed up on streets, on road signs in California. And I started really working hard to learn, and then the effort just went nowhere. I've never really been sure why the U.S. metrification effort has basically failed. We can be pretty sure it's not going to come up this year during the election year because the last thing any candidate wants to do is sounding like they're being European. So we're not going to have to deal with metric. But you know, the one thing I never was able to really wrap my head around for metrification was measuring temperature in Celsius. I have Fahrenheit pretty well nailed. I think most of us do. We know what, you know, it's 20 degrees Fahrenheit outside. Yeah, I can get my head around that. Minus 5 Celsius? Is that cold or really cold? I've really had a hard time getting my head around Celsius. So I'll give everybody a pass on Celsius, but I'm not going to give you a pass on the Kelvin. And the reason is that the Kelvin is actually a physically related temperature scale. It's going to be of importance to us. So what's a Kelvin? Well, if I could get a super microscope and actually see the molecules bouncing around either in this room here where I'm making an awful lot of hot air and we're all breathing out here, it's comfortable here, and then I walk outside and it's a fairly cold day, it's in the 20s out there today, what I would see is the molecules of air would be moving much more slowly when the air is cold. They're moving much more rapidly when the air is fast. The amount of energy in motion, their kinetic energy, taken on average, is a measure of the internal energy of this parcel of gas. And I could do this not even just for gases, I can also do it for solids. I can ask, what is the temperature of a solid being? Well, the atoms there are not freely bouncing around like gas particles in a box. They're all kind of bound to their neighbor particles by electromagnetic forces. But as one atom wiggles, the other atom wiggles. And if you could look at sort of detail, I would be, you know, all the atoms in my body are doing some, and your bodies are doing some kind of jittery dance back and forth. If I was really cold, that jittery vibrational dance would be very slow. If it was really hot, the jittery vibrational dance is really, really fast. Until the energy per single jump becomes of order the binding energy, and what happens? You begin to break free of the solid and you begin to evaporate. You turn into a vapor. Or you break into a liquid, which is an intermediate state between a solid and a gas. So expressing the temperature of a solid or a liquid or a gas is really physically making a statement not about this qualitative sensation of it feels cold, it feels hot, but we want to quantify it. The quantification point turns out to be the amount of internal energy measured by how fast the atoms are either bouncing around freely in a gas or vibrating, how much vibrational energy there is in a solid or liquid. Well, the way this scale was set was by this grouchy-looking old gentleman here, William Thomson, a.k.a. Lord Kelvin, a British physicist from the late 19th century, who was the first person to really come up with a self-consistent definition of the really feeling of temperature and defined what we now refer to as the Kelvin scale. What's different about the Kelvin scale that separates it from the Celsius or Fahrenheit scales is the Kelvin scale is an absolute scale. Okay? And it is a measurement of the internal energy content. By internal energy content, what I mean is if I double the internal energy of something, a parcel of gas, a lump of rock, I will double its temperature when measured in Kelvins. So a change in temperature when measured in Kelvins directly measures the change in internal energy. So, for example, the zero of the Kelvin scale is absolute zero. It's a theoretical point that, classically speaking, all motion comes to a stop. So all those little balls bouncing around in the parcel of gas would literally fall to the bottom of the box and sit there unmoving. If you had a solid material where the atoms are all jiggering and jumping back and forth, at absolute zero, they would be absolutely locked relative to each other in a solid lattice. Even a rock or a crystal looks solid to us, but at the microscopic scale, it's always vibrating around. But if you could make that crystal or that rock absolute zero, it would literally freeze. It's now the absolute definition of freezing. There's no internal motion. Now, this is a classical concept. When you start bringing in the modern view of matter as quantum mechanics, this becomes more nuanced. You can never reach absolute zero. You can only get really, really close to it. I was looking up this morning in Google, what is the current record holder for temperature? It's measured in nanokelvins. But it's still not zero. It's just getting really close. Okay. The next stage, which gets us up to more things we can understand, is 273 degrees Kelvin, is where pure water freezes. That's the zero point, as I'll remind you, of the Celsius scale. At 373 degrees Kelvin, pure water boils at 100 degrees Celsius, 212 Fahrenheit. Now, as a little bit of an aside, you can see how the zero point is set. Zero internal energy, zero motion, zero Kelvin. As I go up to 273 and 373 Kelvin, you can see that the difference between 0 Celsius and 100 Celsius looks like that's a whole bunch. But it really is only an incremental increase. It's only a third of the energy. I only give it half again as much in round numbers, internal energy, and I go from ice to vapor. So liquid water exists in a very, very narrow range of internal energy compared to the total scale of internal energy you can get to. To put some other numbers on top of this just in words, the surface of the sun is about 5,000 degrees Kelvin. The surface of an extremely hot star is maybe 50,000 degrees Kelvin. So these numbers are going to be very important to us. Because one of the things we're going to be looking at are like planetary surfaces and saying, what is the surface temperature there? That's really a statement of how much internal energy there is received from its star. And we need to be able to relate that back to things like what those energy sources are. So we're going to have to use the Kelvin scale because we're going to be doing these kinds of calculations. How warm should it be on a planet which is thus and such conditions, thus and such far away from a star of a certain brightness? That may make the difference between whether that planet is capable of having liquid water or not. And that is one of the criteria, as we'll see, for whether a planet can have life. Any questions about the Kelvin scale? This one's a little unfamiliar to people. We're going to see it again off and on. You'll do a couple homework problems that'll work it. Okay. So let's just sort of set some size scales here. So we're used to human size scales, and the human size scale is the meter. I'm a little under 2 meters tall. That's probably true of most of the adults in this room. You know, an arm span is about 2 meters across. So a meter is a nice, convenient unit to use when measuring kind of human scale things. Even the size of this classroom is you know, I barely break 10 meters front to back. So again, meters are a nice size scale for talking about sort of human scale things. What if we start going up some powers of 10? Okay, so a meter is kind of the size of a person. 10 meters is kind of the size of a room. 100 meters is kind of the size of a building. So for example, this is McPherson Laboratory, and there's my office. If I wanted to go 100 meters from my office, I'd find myself somewhere in the middle of the southern wing of Smith Laboratory, just across the courtyard. So 100 meters is the size of a building. This is how you can kind of get the idea of meters in your head. I want you to kind of get used to thinking about these things. Let's go up another power of 10. 1,000 meters, and now we're going to call it a kilometer. I apologize for the colors here. It got kind of washed out. That would be my office in McPherson Lab to just across the river over in the sports fields on West Campus. 100 meters, by the way, is pretty close to a U.S. football field length. So now that's my two football references for the year, and at least I've met my contractual obligation, at least for the week. It's Ohio State. We've got to say something about sports at some point. So person size is a meter. Building size is room size is 10 meters. Building size is 100 meters. 1,000 meters, a kilogram, is kind of a complex size. It's the size of a university campus or a couple of city blocks. We go up to a kilometer. And 10 kilometers now, 10,000 meters, we're now on city scales. So my starting point is still McPherson Laboratory, but now I'm way across not only the Olentangy River, but the Scioto River, and Scioto River right there, and I'm out into what used to be cornfields when I first moved to Columbus, and now is a housing development out past Arlington. So Hilliard and these neighborhoods are out in here. So 10 kilometers is city-sized, and a modest-sized city is tens of kilometers. All right, let's go up to the next power of 10, to 100 kilometers. 100 kilometers, I start getting to be a significant size of a state. So, for example, for Columbus, Franklin County, if I go 100 kilometers due west of here, I actually end up on the shores of the Great Miami River between Troy and Tipp City, Ohio. So 100 kilometers now becomes sort of the size of a large polity in the United States, which we call states. It's a little bit bigger than a county, maybe 3-4 counties across, but it's now a large unit of political organization. Let's go up another factor of 10 to 1,000 kilometers. 1,000 kilometers gets me from Columbus out to almost all the way to western Missouri. In fact, in due west, thank you Google Earth, I'm almost exactly somewhere in the middle of the ag lands of Andrew County, Missouri, just about ready to cross over into Nebraska, Kansas there. So 1,000 kilometers is now about the size of a nation in round numbers, a larger body of political organization. In other words, thousands of kilometers really measure continental scales on the surface of a Earth-sized planet. Let's go up another factor of 10 to 10,000 kilometers. Now we're talking intercontinental scales. If I wanted to go exactly, well, on at least a great circle path, I said, well, what's the nearest thing I get 10,000 kilometers away from Columbus? I actually get to the Pacific coast of eastern coast of Japan. So I've now crossed a significant fraction of the Earth's surface. The circumference of the Earth in round numbers is 40,000 kilometers. So I've gone from meter scales, which are human scales. When I get to scales of 10,000 kilometers, I'm on planetary scales. So it's only, he says, about 7 orders of magnitude difference between the scale of a person and the scale of a planet. 7 orders of magnitude. And we have 10,000 kilometers. And what's nice about this is I've gone from city size, stuff size scales to planetary scales using meters and kilometers. So it's actually 2 fairly convenient units for us to use. When I start wanting to go off the planet, life starts getting a little stickier. Let's go to another factor of 10, out to 100,000 kilometers. Actually, 100,000 kilometers gets us right in the middle of nowhere, basically in what's called cislunar space, the space between the Earth and the Moon. If I want to get all the way to the Moon, I've got to go almost 400,000 kilometers on average, 384,000 to be exact. So I've now gone a couple 100,000 kilometers, and I haven't even gotten out of the local planetary system. I've just barely gotten to our Moon. So it's pretty clear as we start wanting to talk about astronomical scales, scales of planetary systems, I suddenly started accruing an awful lot of zeros and an awful lot of words. So we're going to need to rebase our unit system at this point. So we're going to stick to kilometers when we talk about planetary scales. But once we step off a planet into planetary systems, we need a new unit. Because otherwise we're going to be carrying an awful lot of thousands and millions and billions around. We have a unit. We're going to use a different yardstick. We're not going to use a meter as a fundamental yardstick now. We're going to use the geometry of our own solar system. And the geometry we're going to use is the average distance of the Earth from the Sun. So this is kind of an oblique view sketch of the inner solar system, the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And I'm going to define an astronomical unit, or the AU for short. This is a very important one we're going to use over and over again. This is the mean or average distance from the Earth to the Sun. Now, the Earth is actually on an elliptical orbit with the Sun at one focus. It comes closest to the Sun, oh, by the way, today. May not feel like it out there, but we are actually closer to the Sun now than we are in July by a few million kilometers, and gets far away in July. But the average distance, when you average over that ellipse, mathematically, it's semi-major axis, for those of you who love your geometry, is a distance of approximately 150 million kilometers, or 1.496 times 10 to the 8 kilometers, and we'll define that as the astronomical unit. Now, there's a lot of reasons historically why the astronomical unit is used rather than kilometers. One is, I don't know about you, but slinging around 150 million kilometers is just, I'm going to run out of steam really fast on doing that math in my head. But if I rescale my units so it's 1, oh, I like 1. That's an easy number to work with. Then if something is 10 times further away, oh, that's 10 AUs. And I don't have to go, oh, that's 101.496 billion kilometers. I have a lot easier time dealing with AUs in solar system. After all, when you're starting to talk about planetary scales, doing things fine-grained on kilometers, it doesn't really matter anymore. You're not dealing with kilometers. You're dealing with millions of kilometers. So we're going to use astronomical units whenever we start talking about interplanetary distances. So let's take a quick look at some of these scales. So the astronomical unit is sort of average Earth to Sun distance. It's about 150 million kilometers in round numbers. That's one of the few big numbers I want you to kind of keep in your head, is that the AU is about 150 million. Don't worry about the 1.496. I'm not going to ask you to memorize numbers. I don't memorize them either. I look them up. But some of them we should know at least, you know, having your fingers the order of magnitude. An AU is 150 million kilometers in round numbers. It's a good number to keep in mind. Okay. So let's now look down upon the solar system so it actually the orbits look a little bit more rational than an oblique view. If I want to go from 1 AU to 10 astronomical units, 10 astronomical units actually gets me to about the orbit of Jupiter. The orbital diameter of Jupiter in round numbers is about 10.4 astronomical units. I just happen to know that one because I do a lot of stuff with Jupiter in the last few years. So within 10 astronomical units, I encompass the Sun, the 4 interterrestrial planets, the main belt of asteroids, and the first of the gas giants, Jupiter. What if I want to go up to the next power of 10 to 100 astronomical units? That actually turns out to be the size scale of the main body of the whole solar system. So there's only two orders of magnitude, 2 powers of 10, between the size of the Earth's orbit to kind of the outer reaches of what I'd call the main body of the solar system. So this purple curve is the outer orbit of Pluto, the dwarf planet that used to be the ninth planet. Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, and that 10 astronomical units I showed before is in the yellow square here in the middle. And then, of course, all these little blue dots are things like Kuiper Belt objects and comets and things like that. So within 100 astronomical units, I actually give you the main body, the main bulk of the mass of the solar system is well contained within that. Let's go up another power, 10 to 1,000 astronomical units. At 1,000 astronomical units, I'm getting out into the outermost weird icy bits of the solar system. This is an object called Sedna, which is probably one of the most distant confirmable objects that we know of. It was actually discovered about right here, but its orbit is a long ellipse, which is going to take it out nearly to 1,000 astronomical units from the Sun. Really getting out into the outer reaches to where we're now starting to get to near the boundary between interstellar and interplanetary space. So the astronomical unit is something that's going to be very useful to us when we talk about planetary size systems, both our planetary system and planetary systems around other stars. But when we want to now reach from our star to the nearest star, even astronomical units are going to be a bit of a pain. For example, the typical distance to the nearest stars is more than 200,000 astronomical units. We're back to the same place we were when we talked about the distance of the Earth to the Moon. We're already up to 100,000, and we've barely gotten to the first star. So, for example, we now want to go to a couple of different units. Professional astronomers use a distant unit called the parsec, which is a technical unit based on a method of measurement. We're not going to use the parsecs in this course. Instead, we're going to use a unit which is a little bit easier for people to wrap their heads around, the light year. The light year is the distance traveled by light in 1 year. So if I fired a light beam off into empty space, 1 year later it would be 1 light year away. In kilometers, that's 9.461 times 10 to the 12 kilometers, about 9.5 trillion kilometers, or about 63,000 astronomical units. So again, this is another place where we're going to introduce a new ruler that makes more sense to us. And the reason for doing this is even the nearest by stars are a little more than 4 light years away. Now, there's a couple different advantages that light years give us. One is it's tied to a fairly familiar idea, the length of a year, and the speed of light, which is the ultimate arbiter of all speeds in the universe. So it's a nice sort of convenient unit to put together. It's a little odd because it's a unit of distance expressed as light travel in 1 year. So we don't actually have units of kilometers in this. It's a little funky, but you get used to it after a while. So let's look at what we get as we move out in scales of light years. So here's a scale of the Sun to the nearest stars, and the nearest star is actually a triple star system, Alpha Centauri, the main body of which and its companion is 400.26 light years away. It has a distant companion called Proxima Centauri. It's actually a red dwarf star, which is currently closer to us by a very small fraction, 0.04 light years. So Proxima is basically in this long, slow outer orbit among these two inner orbiting binaries. It's a really funky little system. But this is the nearest star. We can't see Alpha Centauri from Columbus, but it is a bright star in the southern hemisphere. And this is going to be a very long ways away. This is more than 500,000 astronomical units away. So at this point, we're just going to give up on AUs and talk about light years. When we go out 10 light years, we start getting out into what we call the solar neighborhood. It's basically the nearest by stars. And now this picture here has got this blue circle sort of draws a plane and then divides it into above and below this local plane. So what the circle I just previously drew you, which contains Proxima Centauri and the Sun, that previous picture is this inner yellow circle, about 4 light years across. And then this particular circle here goes out, actually this particular circle that I've drawn goes out about 30 light years around us. And there's a whole bunch of stars in 3 dimensions surrounding us. But notice that it's still a small number of stars, and many of them actually have names, like Sirius, the bright dog star in the winter sky, is actually a relatively nearby star. It's within about 10 light years of the Earth. When I now talk about the massive system of 100 billion stars that we live in, the Milky Way galaxy, I now get up to scales of 26,000 light years. So this is a model of the Milky Way. It's a bright spiral galaxy. We, the Sun, are actually located out here between two of the spiral arms. We're 26,000 light years away from the center of the Milky Way. The Milky Way actually has a well-defined center. It's a dynamical center. It's where everything seems to be the center of mass of the whole system. And there is, as it turns out, a nearly 3 million solar mass black hole sitting at the center of our galaxy. That's a different tale for a different day. So when we start talking about light years is actually going to do us pretty well for the rest of this course. We don't have to start introducing scales that get beyond the scales of galaxies, although we'll see a little bit of that in one of the discussions of the universe as a whole. But we can get away when we talk about distances between stars. It is now light years that we must span, trillions of kilometers. If I wanted to talk about, say, the colonization time of an entire galaxy, then I'm starting to talk about phenomena which are going to be working on tens of thousands of light years. Light, for example, takes nearly, let's see if I draw this in the right way, light takes nearly 100,000 years to cross the Milky Way galaxy. So even if I use the fastest thing I know of, a light signal, and I signal here on the Sun, hey, we're here, we're alive, we can make radio, it would be 26,000 years before that radio signal would reach the galactic center or any other star between. It's these large distances and long time lags that are going to be one of the issues that comes down to giving us some of the problems, if you will, of dealing with interstellar space. We'll see later in the course. So in the end, the final unit I want to introduce is when we talk about masses. I've been leaving them to the end. Masses are a little bit more difficult. We'd love to talk about things in kilograms, but even when you start talking about planetary masses, of which we talk about the Earth as a nice convenient mass unit, the Earth is about 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. So immediately I get into a real problem with planetary size masses. So when I talk about the sizes of planets, I'm going to scale the masses by Earth masses. So instead of telling you how many kilograms is in Jupiter, I can say Jupiter is 318 Earth masses. And that immediately gives you sort of a human scale number, even if it is now referenced to the mass of the Earth. So when we talk about masses of the planets, I will always scale in terms of Earth masses. Occasionally, I might actually scale in terms of Jupiter masses if we're talking about giant gas giants, but that'll be just an anomaly. When I talk about stars, which are 333,000 Earth masses just for the Sun, I'm going to reset my units to the solar mass because the Sun is just a middle-sized star. So Earth masses, solar masses, astronomical units, light years, microns, meters, we got a whole bunch of fun units to use. And tomorrow, we'll start using some of them. Okay, see you all tomorrow.